Following up on considerations of horizontal gene transfer, now we're considering genomes. The product of horizontal gene transfer is change to genomes. That's not the only way that genomes can change, but it certainly is an important way, particularly with regard to the evolution of microorganisms. We're going to be considering genome evolution, particularly from the perspective of horizontal gene transfer, though introducing a couple of other concepts. By and large, a lot of what genome evolution is all about is considered under the heading of molecular evolution, and there actually are courses on molecular evolution, and so molecular evolution per se is not going to be our main interest here. Instead, it's going to be looking at the principles that we've already considered and applying them to genome evolution, and particularly these principles are going to include horizontal gene transfer. So, genomes, and particularly it's the evolution of genomes that we're considering. There are biases in terms of the ability of what donor organisms are able to transfer DNA to what recipient organisms. And in particular, there are some organisms where transfer or exchange of DNA genes is higher, the likelihood is higher, and other organisms for which the likelihood is lower. As a general rule, the closer two organisms are geographically, particularly if they exist within the same environment, the greater the likelihood that there'll be at least some potential for gene exchange between those organisms. But there still are limitations on the ability of some organisms, most organisms, to transfer DNA to most recipient organisms. And as a consequence, the organisms that that are involved in this potential transfer are able to retain a greater similarity among themselves than would be the case if the transfer of DNA between organisms basically had no limitations. So instead of having genomes basically consisting of a random mixture of whatever genes exist in their environment, there instead are biases towards whatever the genes are that were associated with the organism's parents, and in turn, the likelihood of gene exchange with other organisms really is biased towards those organisms that are more closely related to the organism itself. And so as a consequence, the more distantly related two organisms, the less likely that they'll be able to successfully exchange DNA. Now we saw that there's a potential exception to that idea, which we'll get to, but nevertheless, the greatest likelihood of exchange of DNA is seen between those organisms that are most closely related, and you see this particularly among organisms that are obligately sexual, in which they're basically mating with members of their own species in order to produce viable and successful offspring. So what limits gene exchange among organisms? So the first easiest answer to that is that if you're dependent upon homologous recombination for successful gene exchange, then it really is going to be sequence similarity that is the key determinant of whether or not gene exchange is going to be possible. There are other things that can play a role in deciding whether or not orthologous replacement is going to occur, but given that DNA makes its way into the cytoplasm or the nucleus of an organism, then the potential for that DNA to homologously recombine into the chromosomes of that organism is a function of sequence similarity. So more distantly related organisms display less sequence similarity and as a consequence have less of potential to have their DNA recombined homologously into recipient organisms' genomes. If you have too great similarity, however, you're going to have difficulty actually detecting whether or not orthologous replacement has occurred. And the extreme of this is if you have gene exchange between clones. If the sequence of the incoming DNA is the same of the is the same as the equivalent sequence in the recipient organism, then even if you had horizontal gene exchange, even if you had homologous recombination of that DNA into the recipient organism's genome, you're not going to actually be able to see that recombination event in the course of sequencing these genomes. Similarly, If you have small differences between the sequence of the incoming DNA and the recipient's DNA, after the process of homologous recombination, there's a process known as mismatch correction or mismatch repair that actually serves as a DNA repair mechanism that can have the effect of reducing the number of differences between the recipient DNA and the donor DNA, particularly by modifying the recipient DNA. So if you've got a heteroduplex piece of DNA that is the product of homologous recombination, one of the strands of the double helix is the strand that is associated with the donor organism, and the other one is the strand that's associated with the recipient organism. There is a mechanism that will actually modify the donor piece of DNA such that differences, point mutational differences between, or point differences, single nucleotide differences between the two DNAs that are now sitting making up the same DNA double helix will be modified so that, in fact, they end up being the same nucleotide or the complementary nucleotide to the nucleotide sequence seen in the recipient organism. So, in other words, even if you have slight differences that potentially could be detected via sequencing methods, those differences, in fact, can be lost over the course of acquisition of the DNA, over the course of its integration into the recipient organism's chromosome. You also have the potential for physiological incompatibility. So, with orthologous replacement, you're taking a segment of DNA that is evolved and potentially co-evolved with the organism it's found in, and replacing it with DNA that has come from a different organism that presumably, if it's sufficiently different that you can detect that it's a novel piece of DNA, it displays differences in physiology that such that the incoming piece of DNA may not be compatible with the physiology of the recipient organism as the piece of DNA that it's replacing. And if that's the case, then you may see selection against this piece of this newly acquired piece of DNA, and thus its potential loss from the population. And similarly, we can have structural incompatibilities whereby the interaction of the products of these genes, not in a metabolic or physiological sense, but instead in a structural sense, the actual fitting together of gene products may be less likely for a gene that has been transferred into a genome versus the gene that was already there. This is also speaking in terms of orthologous replacement, basically taking a piece of DNA, a gene that has already been present within an organism's genome, and replacing it with a piece of DNA, a gene that has come from another organism. And the likelihood is that the gene is going to have been more compatible with the organism it sits in rather than a gene that comes from another organism, simply because there will be a favoring by natural selection of an increasing degree of compatibility between the genes found in a genome and the rest of the genes found in that genome. And a new gene coming in is simply not going to have been subject to that natural selection yet. And so, therefore, in all likelihood, will display a lower potential to benefit the recipient organism than, in fact, the original gene or piece of DNA can. And as a consequence, the incoming DNA will tend to be lost as a consequence of natural selection. We also have a less likelihood that vectors such as bacteriophages or plasmids are going to be able to transfer DNA from between more distantly related organisms versus between more closely related organisms. And as a consequence of that, the likelihood of transfer of DNA simply will decline as phylogenetic distance increases. Now, it's possible for DNA to hop from one organism to organism to organism following a host range overlaps. But even in that case, the incoming piece of DNA has to be retained within the intermediate recipient host organism for long enough for it to be picked up by another vector and moved on to yet another host organism. And if the piece of DNA is not selectively beneficial to this intermediate organism, it's not really going to be retained in the population, and therefore the likelihood of transfer is not going to be high. So as a consequence, even if you've got a multi-step process that can move DNA from one organism to some more distantly related organism due to a consequence of overlapping host ranges associated with the vectors, each of these steps is not going to be of high likelihood. And as a consequence, the likelihood of great movement outside of a single vector's host range is going to be much lower than the likelihood of movement within a individual vector's host range. And vectors tend to, like bacteriophages, tend to be reasonably limited in the kinds of organisms they can, they're able to transfer DNA between. And these organisms tend to be clusters of more closely related organisms rather than more distantly related organisms. And so there is simply a bias in the potential for transduction or conjugation to move DNA between distantly related organisms versus more phylogenetically closely related organisms. You also have the potential for ecological incompatibilities, and thus, if you're not talking any longer about orthologous replacement, but instead this zone of paralogy that we talked about earlier, where you have an insertion of a novel piece of DNA, if that novel piece of DNA is going to be useful to its recipient, it's usually the case that the donor and the recipient will have similar ecological functions or needs, and as a consequence, the reception of a new gene will be able to be functional in the recipient organism. However, if the ecologies of the two organisms are substantially different, such as movement of DNA between a heterotrophic organism into an autotrophic organism, it could very well be that the DNA will be less useful, the received gene will be less useful than if the gene instead is passed between organisms that display more similar ecology, such as between two heterotrophs. And even given potential utility, if that utility is rare, such as antibiotic resistance, then there's a reasonably high likelihood that a gene, in fact, is going to be lost before the selective conditions for that gene are even encountered by an organism. So from the perspective of a vector such as a plasmid that carries certain genes that might be useful to a host organism, those genes may not be useful to the organism at the time the vector is received, and therefore the vector, natural selection is not necessarily going to favor its retention. On the other hand, plasmids often contain multiple useful genes, such as multiple resistance genes, and as a consequence of that, the likelihood that the recipient organism is going to encounter conditions that will select for a gene that's carried by a plasmid is much higher, simply because there's a greater variety of conditions, ecological conditions, that may select for that vector if indeed these multiple genes are carried by it. And so that might be the explanation for why plasmids often carry multiple antibiotic resistance genes. In addition, there are genes associated with many plasmids that tend to set things up so that the plasmid in fact creates its own selective conditions such that it produces toxins or poisons and also antidotes or antitoxins that if the plasmid is lost from a host organism, then the antitoxin, in a sense, is lost as well, and the remaining toxin will kill the host organism. And the consequence of the encoding of these kinds of features by plasmids sets things up so that the utility, in fact, is not rare, because the utility of the genes carried by the plasmid suddenly become viable, relevant, simply because the plasmid is there. And so there's this correspondence between plasmid presence and the selective conditions that should favor the continuing presence of the plasmid. So here again is our zone of paralogy, where we have phylogenetic distance increasing along the x-axis and frequency of successful transfer increasing along the y-axis. And way up here is basically the successive transfer of genes, DNA, between closely related organisms, such as within individual species or even within individual strains. The problem is that you're not going to actually be able to see these transfers using sequencing technology, because you're not going to actually have a great, a substantial amount of sequence difference between the original DNA and the DNA that replaces it via the horizontal gene transfer event. So we see declines here that are at least in part as a consequence of reduced homology, but also come about as a consequence of reduced physiological or reduced structural compatibilities in terms of the gene products that are produced by a given gene and the metabolism and physiology of the organism that is the recipient of that gene via orthologous replacement. And we see a decline over here that could be in part a consequence of reduced likelihood of transfer between the two organisms. For example, as you get farther and farther distantly phylogenetically, the likelihood that you're going to have transfers in terms of plasmids or transfers via transduction become less and less. And what you're seeing here in the zone of paralogy is a combination of short-term and long-term retention of what are clearly transferred genes. These are genes that are not a product of orthologous replacement, but instead are a result of insertion or illegitimate recombination mechanisms. And so if you're comparing two genomes of closely related organisms and one has an insertion and one is lacking that insertion, the differences between the two are either a consequence of the insertion of laterally transferred genes or instead the deletion of some portion of a genome. A third possibility is that you can have insertions that are the result of duplication of segments of DNA from one portion of the genome to another. But if you see genes that are clearly not already a part of the genome and they're not associated with the genomes of closely related organisms, then it's likely that the insertion event was in fact a product of horizontal gene transfer. What we see here is actually something similar to what we saw in the previous slide. And so the tan represents essentially the likelihood of reception of a gene, and the positive selection represents the likelihood of retention of a gene. Positive selection is essentially selection on whatever is received by an organism, in this case by horizontal gene transfer. And if the gene increases the fitness of the organism, then there'll be positive selection on that gene for the retention of that gene. So more genes make it into an organism than are actually retained by the organism following horizontal gene transfer events. Now, if you've got transfer going on within species, then you'll have retention of a lot of, or you have transfer of a lot of genes, particularly because there's a large overlap in these infectious vectors, such as viruses, phages, conjugative plasmids. But the positive selection is not going to be high, simply because the differences between the recipient gene, the gene that is replaced in the recipient, and the gene that comes from the donor organism, they're going to be slight, and therefore the fitness differences are going to be slight. And where there are differences, chances are they're going to be detrimental. So the likelihood of these genes being beneficial is relatively low, and that's what that small green circle is indicating right there. Lots of potential for transfer, not a lot of potential for selection for what has been transferred. Between species, which is another way of saying more distant phylogenetically between the donor and the recipient, more distance phylogenetically between the donor and recipient, you have a smaller likelihood of transfer. at all, and that's what that small circle is, but a higher likelihood of positive selection on whatever has been transferred. And this is again because when you have especially insertions, you may not be eliminating the existing information within the recipient, and you have the potential for supplying some novel function which might be beneficial to the recipient. So when you have within species that is a low phylogenetic distance, lots of likelihood of transfer, low likelihood that there'll be selection for the transfer. When you have between species, that is the greater phylogenetic difference, you have a low likelihood of transfer, but a much higher likelihood of selection on whatever has been transferred, particularly if it's an illegitimate recombination or insertion of a prophage or reception of a plasmid that is associated with that horizontal gene transfer. So this is likelihood of acquisition, and this is likelihood of retention, so likelihood of recombination, and likelihood of positive selection. Whenever you have selection for something, its likelihood of being retained within a population is higher. So this is likely due to a high amount of homology, as well as a sharing of vectors. And this is unlikely because, and this is small because the new, the incoming DNA is unlikely to add anything worth keeping to the recipient organism, simply because it's not going to be likely to be adding anything new to the recipient organism. Or if it does, that newly added DNA may be incompatible with the recipient organism. Here is another way of looking at the evolution of bacterial genomes, but consistent with the way we've been considering it so far. And so this is the bacterial genome. You have ways of increasing the DNA content within that genome. It's either occurs as a consequence of duplication events of already existing DNA within the genome or horizontal gene transfer. Similarly, you have potential for loss of DNA from the recipient, from the bacterial genome, so removal of DNA. This can occur as a consequence of loss, deletion mutations, and it can occur as a consequence of mutations that simply inactivate genes. In this latter case, you can have further loss of the DNA itself via deletion mutation. So you have incoming, either duplication or horizontal gene transfer, and outgoing ultimately is by deletion, although you can have an intervening step that involves simply mutational inactivation. And if a bacterial genome is going to remain more or less constant in size over time, then these two processes have to balance. Anytime you have increases in DNA, there's got to be a balancing mechanism of decrease in DNA. And so there's a gene acquisition loss balance that's expected if you have a bacterial genome that stays relatively constant in size over time. We have an expectation that increases in the size of a bacterial genome will be things that are supported by natural selection, so either duplications or acquisition of genes by horizontal gene transfer that result in increases in the fitness of bacterium. Or alternatively, the losses are going to be things that either are actually supported by natural selection, so there may be benefits associated with either inactivation or deletion, or alternatively, these are things that are lost because natural selection is no longer supporting their retention. So essentially, they represent each neutral alleles that simply are lost from a genome as a consequence of genetic drift. We've looked at ideas of this combination of horizontal gene transfer and natural selection already. In terms of moron accretion, you've got bacteriophages. They, via illegitimate recombination, acquire a new gene or segment of DNA. And then that new gene is either supported by natural selection, it either provides a benefit to the carrier of that gene, or it does not. If it supplies a benefit, then what you will end up with is perhaps a new gene genome that contains one extra gene that then can acquire further genes. Alternatively, if the retention of this new gene is not under natural selection, then you'll have an expectation that the gene, the new genome with the new gene, will be lost from the population. So it's only those horizontal gene transfer experiments that tend to increase natural selection that have a relatively high likelihood of being retained within populations. We've also talked about you are what you eat, which is a mechanism of acquisition, especially by phagocytic protists, of foreign DNA. And once again, you have new DNA coming in. If that DNA supplies a selective benefit, then that DNA will tend to be retained. If it doesn't supply a selective benefit, it will tend to be lost. If you have an existing piece of DNA that no longer supplies a benefit to the organism carrying it, then it will tend to be eroded from the genome. It'll be mutationally inactivated, converted into pseudogenes, and eventually potentially deleted from genomes. The idea of you are what you eat benefits from the fact that eukaryotic cells tend to have much looser genomes than do prokaryotic cells. If you look at a graph of genome size, keeping in mind this is an exponential scale down here, on the x-axis and on the y-axis you have gene density, you find that the number of genes per unit DNA is much lower among the eukaryotes than it is among the prokaryotes. And one consequence of this is that incoming DNA has some place to go in these eukaryotes, that if you have some means by which DNA can enter into a eukaryotic genome, it has the potential to find its way into the chromosomes of the eukaryotic cell and basically just sit there and not really have all that great an impact necessarily on the fitness of the eukaryote. So if you have a mechanism of input, you could have, in fact, a eukaryotic genome that keeps growing and growing and growing without the same kind of constraints on genome size that you typically see among prokaryotes and also among viruses. So looking at this, the big picture, if we've got eukaryotes not being immune to horizontal gene transfer, that means there's more horizontal gene transfer going on than just the acquisition of the endosymbionts, mitochondria, and chloroplasts. Although, as we'll see, there are more endosymbionts out there than just these two. There's a lot more ways in which eukaryotic organisms can, in fact, acquire genes via horizontal gene transfer. This can happen in the higher eukaryotes as a consequence of the movement of genes via viruses, but it can also happen in the protists as a consequence of mechanisms such as you are what you eat. And so during the evolution of the eukaryotes, with phagocytosis as a prominent means by which acquisition of nutrients took place, you have this potential for genes entering into, by a number of different pathways, a number of different steps of horizontal gene transfer, ultimately that have found their way into the present day organisms, including those organisms that evolved from the phagocytic protists, such as ourselves. And then you also have all sorts of horizontal gene transfer going on to this day among the bacteria, among the archaea, and so you've got this potential for all sorts of innovation that can occur in one lineage finding its way into another lineage, and thus coming up with something completely novel that essentially represents the combination of two lineages together. Rather than each lineage being isolated and able to increase its genetic repertoire, particularly as a consequence of mutation, you've got many lineages that are increasing its genetic repertoire via mutation, but then are able to transfer those genes, or have those genes transferred between them as a consequence of horizontal gene transfer. So there should be a lot more inter and intra-domain transfers shown up here than you're actually seeing. And in fact, if you're looking at horizontal gene transfer altogether, if you're looking at the evolution of life, it looks more like this than the previous slide indicates. Although I'm not convinced yet that this is not simply a piece of art, but nevertheless, there's a lot of potential, a lot of steps, a lot of horizontal gene transfer that likely is was present in the past of all of the organisms on Earth. Many, many horizontal gene transfer steps leading from the origin of the universal ancestor to the organisms that are present today. Yeah, so this is perhaps more accurate, but still without question fanciful.